From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. This morning we speak first with sports and health journalist Christine Yu. She writes about groundbreaking science of women athletes in her new book, Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. And then local resident and author Joel Zuckerman will join us to talk about an upcoming speaker series talk on how focused, proactive, day-to-day gratitude can have a transformative effect on a person's health, well-being, and outlook. That's coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Christine Yu is an award-winning journalist focusing on the intersection of sports science and women athletes. In her reporting on elite athletes and talking with experts in the field of sports science, she noticed that even as women have excelled in sports, there's an underlying sense that women and their bodies are an anomaly in the athletic world. Christine realized how little we know about the understanding of the female physiology and sports performance. We welcome her to the show to discuss her new book on the subject. It's called Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Christine Yu, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'd like to jump right into this as far as the fact that you say the women's body are an anomaly and we don't know enough about it. What are the things that we're discovering about the female body that we didn't before?
Yeah, so it's kind of wild. So most of what we know about exercise, training, performance, injury prevention, injury recovery, even clothing and gear is primarily based on research that have been done with men and male bodies, male animals. And so we are making a lot of assumptions about how the body adapts to training, how it performs, based on a partial picture of the human population. And so, you know, what that means is that for a lot of girls and women, we're oftentimes left without appropriate or adequate guidance because the research doesn't actually reflect our bodies or our lived experience. So there's a question as to whether or not, you know, there could be better ways of doing things that are more tailored or appropriate to women and their bodies.
So in this tailoring on the subject of nutrition, there's a lot of information about nutrition and sports athletes and how they provide the fuel for their body that they need. And is there a different protocol for men and women? Have we noticed any differences between certain nutrition going in one body versus another?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the bigger picture on the whole, generally no, right? Because for both men and women, the most important thing is just that you're eating enough. And we find that that can be a hard thing for, especially for girls and women, but also for men, right? Just making sure that you're eating enough, not only to support your body through just living its daily life, but also to do all these incredible things that you're trying to do on the trails, on the mountain, on a bike, or whatever it is, right? You know, kind of big picture, there isn't necessarily a huge difference. Where there might be some differences is in terms of how the body metabolizes certain food groups. So like carbohydrates or fats. And so in general, you know, women tend to metabolize fats better than men. And so that might have implications for, you know, kind of longer endurance events. If women can metabolize fat better, can tap into those higher energy stores. But it is very much a field that scientists are still exploring and still learning a lot more. But yeah, it's super exciting. And I think, but again, I think like the key point is that folks really need to make sure they're just eating enough.
That's interesting. Christine, I feel like this concept or the premise of your book, that basically we don't understand women's bodies, that they're that really the science isn't there, that it hasn't been done, that we apply this research that has been done on men's bodies and just apply it to women. I find that really surprising. I mean, I feel like on this show, poor David, we talk about menopause all the time and books that have been written about menopause. And I'm just wondering why it is that women's bodies, when it comes to athleticism, haven't really been studied.
Yeah, I think in large part it's it's really, if you look at the history of sports and women's involvement in sports, right? Women really haven't been involved in sports until fairly recently. You know, Title IX passed just 51 years ago. So it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty short period of time. Whereas sports from the very beginning, from the get-go, has been this arena for men and for men to kind of demonstrate their masculinity, for men to compete. So of course, right, that's the population people are going to focus on and are going to study. And in the same way with science, when the sports science field really developed, again, it was kind of men and male scientists who were running the labs, doing the tests, and the population that they were working with, again, were largely men. And so when they started to develop those original like methodology and protocols as to like, how do you actually study a body exercising, a body under stress, they were developing all these protocols, you know, given the population they were working with, right, which were men. And so those protocols became the standard. And when those scientists train their students, that's what the students learn. When those students then go off and start their own labs and train their students, that protocol just trickles down and it becomes this thing that you almost don't even realize or recognize that, huh, we are only studying half the population, you know, of the human, or half of the human population. We're kind of missing this other piece, but it's a blind spot because you've never studied it from the beginning.
Yes. I don't know if you're familiar with this story, but it was a big deal here in Park City. And we have so much talk of Olympic athletes. And it was about a dozen years ago when the women Nordic ski jumpers decided that they really wanted to rally around being accepted as an Olympic sport. Like, why do men get to ski jump in the Olympics, but not women? And there was such antiquated and archaic words that came out of the IOC saying, oh, women aren't, they shouldn't jump like this because it could hurt their bodies, you know, to almost, I can't remember. It kind of went about, you know, childbearing and things like that. Yeah. So obviously from the nodding of your head, you're familiar with that. And I thought that was a one-off. I thought that's so, it's so archaic. This really is, you know, what you're talking about in your book.
It's wild. Yeah. So they thought that the impact of landing from ski jumps would essentially make, it was either the uterus or the ovaries, like essentially burst upon impact. And I'm like, really? Like, and like you said, this wasn't very long ago. And it wasn't very long ago that women actually finally got this to, you know, do this event in the Olympics. It was 2014. When I was looking at the research on this, it was one, enraging and infuriating, but also just so surprising that these myths and these like belief, you know, kind of misconceptions about women's bodies and what we're capable of doing or how fragile they can be continue to persist, right? I mean, we even see it in talk of, you know, or not wanting to talk about like menstrual cycle or cramps. Michaela Schifrin was talking about it in, was it January, February, when she was breaking Lindsey Vonn's record, saying that she was competing and like a bad part of her cycle. But it's like, again, almost this like embarrassment to talk about this. Whereas it's, no, this is a daily, this is a part of a daily life of, you know, people who are women in female bodies.
Agreed. It's as a male, it's one of those things that I don't fully understand and can't, that I'm not in tune with the struggles that are happening on a daily basis for a female, especially in the world of athletics, because it's really hard to perform on any level, let alone when you're going through some kind of body change that happens for you guys inevitably. And so going back to the science and how we're still exploring the science of this and the lack of research, and I'm curious, who is funding these scientific research programs? And because if it's company, you know, if it's like the NFL or the NBA, maybe they're putting all their money and research into the male athlete because that's where their cash cow is. And so who's providing the funding for this research?
Yeah, that's a really great question because, right, scientific research is not inexpensive. It's really expensive to carry out. And so there needs to be funding. There are agencies, government agencies like the NIH, National Institutes of Health, that does provide funding for research, but a lot of that focuses on more public health issues, right? Like disease prevention or cancer, you know, research. And so not a lot trickles down to sports science. So that means that researchers do have to depend on, you know, other sources of funding like the NFL, like the NBA, who obviously they care about their athletes. They want their athletes to perform well because that's their product. And like you said, they prioritize, you know, those male sports. And so that's where the research is going to go. Similarly with the NCAA, they also fund research. But again, as we've learned in recent years, like men's basketball, that's the, and football is their cash cow, right? It's where their investment is. And so again, they're going to focus on men. So it has been really hard for researchers to get funding to look at issues specific to women. I think it's, you know, it's starting to change. There are some private funders coming onto the field, to support this work, but it's still an area that, you know, definitely needs a lot more funding.
It's quite remarkable how it's just so archaic in this time, in this age, and going back to the struggles of what females have to deal with. I was reading about in your book, the sports bra and the evolution of female clothing and apparel. And I remember a conversation with my mom and sister, because my sister played soccer back, you know, when I was like in seventh grade, and just the conversation about the sports bra, how it hurt, it didn't fit. So what has been the evolution, and where do we stand with female performance and their, as far as their athletics apparel goes?
Yeah, so sports bra is a funny story, right? So that wasn't developed until 1977, the height of the jogging boom. And, you know, before that, women were essentially either wearing like a smaller size bra or two bras on top of each other. But so there were three women in Vermont that essentially, you know, cut up and sewed together two jock straps and made the first sports bra. But, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense, right? Because people, again, weren't studying breasts and breast motion, because mostly men scientists, mostly men who are just studying biomechanics. I mean, breasts, like, you kind of think of this as this like accessory appendage, if you will, right? Like, what does it have to do with sports? What does it have to do with performance? But if you are a person with breasts, you know very well that breast motion, breast pain can affect how you feel when you're active. And so it really wasn't until the late 2000s, 2010s, where researchers finally got like better technology to look at breast motion. And funny, if you actually study it, then you can actually design a good garment to control that motion and to make it more comfortable. So brands are starting to incorporate a lot of that science into their product design in recent years. But I mean, it's wild to me how overlooked some things are. I mean, you mentioned soccer. There wasn't really a female-specific soccer cleat until like 3 years ago, I think. Again, which is bananas to me, given how popular soccer is as a sport worldwide, right? And, you know, we've seen after the 2019 World Cup, just more interest in it, and, you know, in this upcoming World Cup this summer. And it's, women were making do with using men's shoes, or like they would be unisex shoes, but essentially they were designed based on a man's foot geometry and anatomy. Or if they had smaller feet, they were wearing kids' shoes. And so it's this constant story of women kind of having to, like, you know, fit themselves into whatever available product there was, you know, so just to make do, essentially.
That's so interesting. So what is different about this 3-year-old soccer shoe that is specifically designed for women?
Yeah. So, you know, on a pretty basic level, women's feet are shaped differently. So there tends to be a wider forefoot, a narrower heel compared to men. And so just that in and of itself can change the shape of the actual shoe and how it fits. Because when women were wearing like the men's shoes, sometimes their heel would slip out because the heel would be too wide for them, or the front of their foot would be all squished and they'd get blisters because their forefoot was wider than men's. So that's one piece of it. Women also load their foot differently, right? When you kind of plant and kick. And so that can affect where the placement of the cleats actually are. So if they are placed in a place where women are loading really hard, it could create a lot of discomfort, right? And so again, women are kind of like duct taping their shoes, shaving down cleats to kind of make it more comfortable for them to use. And I mean, as you know, right, if you're not comfortable in your gear, if it's making you tired, like it could make you more tired and fatigued, it could change your like mechanics and how you move, those could all potentially lead to injury too, right? So this new cleat like is designed specifically kind of based on the women's like geometry and like how, like I said, how the foot loads when it moves, hopefully, right, to make a more comfortable shoe. And that's what people have said. Like, they're like, oh, this is actually really comfortable. Like I can actually run like 90 minutes in this and not, you know, kind of futz around with my shoe, you know, in the middle of the game.
Wow. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Christine Yu about her new book, Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. I just want to make a comment about the sports bra before we move on, because I've noticed that now that they've got the design kind of down, the material, the fabric, men will never know what it feels like to have a sweaty sports bra on. You know, they can just whip off their shirt, but we can't. And then also as you age and your shoulders become less flexible, boy, taking off those sports bras over your head is an act of, I don't know. It's painful and it's hard. I just saw a sports bra that has a clasp in the back, you know, so you don't have to do that. So we're learning, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm often afraid I'm going to like dislocate my shoulder one day when I'm taking it off.
It's so true. It's so true. So talk to us a little bit about the research that is being done. How about the way we process fat? You mentioned that in the beginning.
Yeah. So a part of the way that, women process fat is dependent, or, you know, has been linked to our hormones, right? So things like estrogen and progesterone in the body. And so what researchers are doing is they are looking and doing a lot more research, examining the menstrual cycle and what potential impacts different phases of the menstrual cycle might have on things like metabolism, on things like recovery and like muscle soreness and all of that. Because those hormones in the menstrual cycle fluctuate up and down throughout the month, and they have jobs aside from just coordinating our fertility, right? So there are receptors for these hormones throughout the body. And like I said, they play a role in, you know, metabolism, temperature regulation, bone building, bone health. So researchers are really trying to hone in a little bit on, you know, what is actually happening across these different phases. And what might that potentially mean in terms of how women respond to exercise? Does it affect performance? Like, do you perform better at certain phases of the cycle versus another? As well as looking at how things like hormonal contraceptives might affect this as well, because that's a little bit of a different hormonal environment.
Interesting. Another topic I know nothing about. But one thing I can relate, ladies, I want to let you know, is I don't understand the sweaty sports bra, but I am very inflexible. So I too cannot take off a sports bra if I had to be wearing one. But that being said, as far as the science goes, where have we seen, now that the research has become more in our face and apparent, where are women excelling versus men? And where are there any areas that are these upticks that we didn't realize were going to happen as we studied the female body?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting areas really is around endurance. And when we particularly look at ultra endurance events, right? So things in running longer than a marathon, these like 100 mile, 200 mile, you know, foot races, as well as like long mileage backpacking or marathon swimming. And it looks like, you know, as distances get longer, women seem to be performing better, right? There's the gap between the men's and the women's performance starts to close. And in some cases, women do outperform men, you know, either winning races outright. And it's really exciting. It's really interesting. And so the thought is that there might be some physiological reasons for this. You know, we are talking about kind of the fat metabolism and how if women are better able to metabolize fat, maybe, you know, they won't deplete all of their carbohydrate stores as quickly as men. Maybe, you know, they can tap into this higher energy fuel source and use that to power them through these long distance events. Women also seem to have a higher proportion of what's called slow twitch muscle fibers, right? So these muscle fibers that are, that will keep going and going and going, versus men who tend to have more fast twitch muscle fibers, which are really good for like short, powerful bursts of energy. So they might think that women, you know, our muscles tire less quickly compared to men. But on the whole, what I think is really interesting and what, you know, researchers are kind of looking at is, as the distances get longer, it might also seem like those physiological factors might not actually matter as much, right? Because as you're getting, you know, longer distances, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter like what your VO2 max is, or, you know, how you metabolize food. It's actually what might matter is like how you problem solve in that moment, right? How do you deal with adversity? How do you deal with, you know, stomach, like GI distress and stomach issues? Those factors start to move up in importance, if you will. So there's this thought that maybe women can kind of like play their cards a little bit differently, a little bit better than men. But it is an area that, you know, they're still trying to tease apart.
Very interesting. I mean, I've been obsessed with athletics and pushing your body to the limit for a very long time, and so I've never thought of it in that sense, because when you're doing these ultras and stuff, it is absolutely mental, and I don't do that, but at certain points I don't know what that breaking point is, 80 miles, 90 miles, it becomes 100% mental at that point. Your body's broken down, and so for the female to be able to endure that more because of what you guys go through on a daily basis, that's really interesting. And Courtney DeWalter is someone I've followed pretty, and she in these Moab 240 mile races. I mean, she's beaten some of these men. She's getting first place by 30, 40 miles. It's really incredible to watch that go. And Christine, what is your background and why are you so passionate about this topic?
So I was supposed to be a doctor when I was growing up. That was the plan. I wanted to go to medical school. So I've always been really fascinated by the human body and, you know, how it does the things it does. And I've also, you know, played sports all my life, not very good, but, you know, it was something that was an integral part of my life. And I think the combination of those two, right, like just this interest in the human body and then this interest in sports and athletics really led me to want to just understand how the human body performs, right? And how do we improve performance? How do we make ourselves better? How do we also prevent injury? Because I also tend to be a little bit injury prone. So, a little, you know, very personal on that level. But it's just, it's something that has truly fascinated me. And then especially now, as we see women's sports, I think finally, you know, get its due, right? People are starting to pay attention and realizing that, you know, in and of its own right, it's a tremendous, you know, product. It's a tremendous like arena to be in. It's very exciting, right? It's very exciting to think about how can we continue to lift this up?
It is really exciting. Christine, I just, as you've been talking about, especially our bodies, women's bodies and endurance, I used to do a lot of long endurance events, and I would do them with male friends, and they would always bonk. And I would always say, oh, it's okay. My body's just feeding off its own fat. And I was thankful for that. And I'm wondering, I mean, A, it makes you think a lot about what we put in our bodies mm-hmm. to replenish that fat, how much we need to versus the male. And then it also makes me think about, you know, our acceptance. You know, if you're a female athlete, you know, you don't want fat, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you think it shapes how, you know, what we think about our own fat? We need to view it favorably.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that, or I hope that it really starts to change or shift our mindset around thinking about what an ideal body for an athlete looks like, or like what an athlete should look like rather, right? Because we have all of these notions in our mind that you need to be this like long, lean, you know, thin person, but that's not necessarily the case. And each of us, our bodies are so individual. So what might be the optimal kind of body composition or size for me is going to be different from someone else. And there's no one idealized version of what that means. So I'm hopeful that, you know, maybe we can start to, you know, step back from that and to really appreciate our bodies for what they are in and of themselves, rather than what we wish they could be.
Well, it is a great book, and I can really envision people, especially in our area and areas where, you know, sport rules, right? Really enjoying this. So thank you so much for joining us. The book is Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Our guest is Christine Yu. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Well, this morning we welcome into the studio local resident and author, award-winning author, Joel Zuckerman. Often we feel gratitude when someone does something for us that is kind, generous, maybe unsolicited, and it surprises us, but it gives us that deep feeling of gratitude. And I'm wondering, Joel, you join us now to talk about an upcoming talk that you'll give in on the Park City Library Speaker Series on June 6th, a week from today, 6 to 7:30 p.m. What was the genesis of your gratitude, and how have you turned into a gratitude tiger?
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you, Lynn, as always, and David also. The long and the short of it is, 10 years ago, I picked up a famous self-help book, the only self-help book I've ever looked at, and I only looked at it very briefly, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and it's all small stuff. 30 million copies sold. All the chapters are 2 or 3 pages long. They're very little life hacks to live a better life. And one of the chapters said, write a heartfelt letter. And I immediately in my mind transposed that title to write a letter of gratitude. I wrote a letter that very day to a business colleague, and it affected me more than I thought it would. I got his address, I put a stamp on it, envelope, mailbox. I wrote him a letter thanking him for things he had done for me in my previous career. And I was so taken aback by the feeling of writing this letter and how it made me feel, never mind what he thought about it. I wrote another and another and another. And over the last 10 years, I've written now nearly, it sounds so strange to say, almost 215 letters of gratitude. And a couple years ago, I compiled the first 180 into a book called, very simply, Grateful.
Now, I think that, as I said in the intro, that when someone does something for us and we have that feeling of gratitude, it, at least for me, it makes me realize that I don't walk around on a day-to-day basis feeling gratitude. It's more like a practice that you have to develop, that you have to even, you know, sharpen your eye to see, to feel. And you have turned this practice into, yes, a book and a whole movement.
Yes, I'm attempting to be grateful. So I'm going to describe it to you in just two, I'm going to make it real simple. There's so much to this, but I'm going to just cut it down into black and white. There's two types of gratitude. Everyone is reactively grateful. You get a benign diagnosis at the doctor when you were worried about something. A loved one narrowly avoids the accident on the interstate. Oh my God, I'm so grateful. That's 100% of humanity feels that type of reactive gratitude. Mm-hmm. What I'm talking about and what I'll be talking about at the lecture series next week is proactive gratitude. Making a point to be grateful 10 or 20 or more times a day for little things, because let's face it, not every, you're not winning the lottery every day. You're not you know, getting a free lunch every day. But you can be grateful for little things every day. When I go through my gratitude list tonight when I go to bed, which is one of my practices, spending time with you here in the KPCW studio is going to be on the list of things that I was grateful for today.
You're right. It is. Don't sweat those small things, and those small little gratitudes stack up every day. And you say that you learn gratitude from the ground up, brick by brick, as you laid it. And so what are these things that you've learned throughout the last decade as you stack these gratitude things every day?
So my main focus, 90% of my gratitude practice, and I feel funny saying that because I used to be a yogi and people would ask about your yoga practice, your meditation practice. My gratitude practice, 90%, is writing letters of gratitude. Why? Because A, I'm a writer. I've written a lot of books and 1,000 magazine articles. And B, I'm creative. And writing a letter of gratitude beyond saying, "Dear Bill, thanks for being you. Love, Joe." Writing a letter of gratitude takes a little bit of creativity. And third, it has an impact not only on me, the writer, which I said at the beginning of our conversation, but needless to say, on the recipient. So most of my gratitude practice is writing letters of gratitude. And when I go to the library next week to talk about it, I'm going to encourage everyone who comes to hear me and everyone who's listening today to write a letter, at least one letter to someone. And by the way, David, you just got me on a roll. Everyone who's listening to this, think of right now, think of two people to whom you are grateful. One that's with you and one no longer with you. And don't miss the opportunity to tell the person that is still with you, as opposed to the person who is no longer with you, how you feel about them.
What a great little practice. I went through that exercise as you were going through it yourself right there. So when you say you're writing these letters of gratitude, one of my favorite things to do is to write a handwritten card for someone. I love on a birthday or a graduation or Mother's Day or whatever, I enjoy sitting down and actually putting in real thought and effort into what this person means to me. And I found that letter is not only, like you said, done great things for the individual, but it does a lot for me and recognizing the great things they've done for me. So when you talk about these letters of gratitude, are you specifically, like, you know, when you're thanking KPCW for the lens of my time today, are you writing a letter as if it would go to us, or are you just writing the list of the things that you're grateful for that particular day?
So yes, I conflated two things. My gratitude practice, and again, I feel funny using the word practice, basically comes down to two things. Every night when I get in bed, before I attempt to fall asleep, for those 5 or 10 or sometimes 20 minutes, I list chronologically everything I'm grateful for that day. That's easy because you're lying in bed. It's like counting sheep, but you're counting things that you were grateful for that day from the first thing to the last thing. And this will be one of the first things, because it's, you know, relatively early in the day. Tonight when I go to bed at 11 o'clock, this is what I'm grateful for today, boom, 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 hanging out on the radio with you guys will be on that list. That's the easy part of gratitude for me. Writing letters takes effort, takes creativity, takes motivation, but I'm an unusual person, I guess, because I've done it now 215 times over the last 10 years.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with local resident and author Joel Zuckerman. And Joel, we've talked about your book, Grateful, and I'm going to get back to gratitude, which is the topic of the day, but you are a colorful local character, and we love to hear a little bit more. You're cracking up. I met you in Toastmasters some years ago, and I think I have said your name around town, and people go, "Oh yeah, he's the golf guy. He's the golf writer." And so this is what you're known for, is a golf and travel writer. You have won awards. This Grateful is your 9th book, I believe. Can you just go through what you were, what people know you for?
Yes, 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 Lynn. All right. So once upon a time, I was a golf writer. I started my second career for the Hilton Head, South Carolina newspaper. I was hired as a golf columnist. My first column debuted on January 1st, 1998. And after 15 years of spinning my wheels career-wise, trying things that didn't quite fit, I realized I was meant to be a writer. Now, I come from a family of writers. My brother has written four or five books, three or four published plays. My niece has written a best-selling cookbook. My father was a writer. So we are more people of arts and letters than numbers. I got my job as a columnist in Hilton Head, South Carolina, and I very quickly springboarded my way into local magazine work, then regional magazine work, then airline magazines, then national magazines. And then I started writing books, and there was a period of time about 15, 18 years ago when I wrote, I think, 6 books in 8 years. I was either writing, editing, promoting, or planning a book at all times. My books came out in 03, 05, 06, 07, 08. Then the financial crisis hit, and I thought I was all done. But I had a second act and had books come out in 2011, 2013, 2015. But then, after about 2018, wrapped up a couple of things in that business, I realized I had said everything I needed to say about golf. I've spilled oceans of ink writing about golf and golf destinations and players and history. And finally, just like Forrest Gump stopped running one day, he just stopped on the interstate. One day I said, I have said all there is I'm ever going to say about golf. And then I started thinking more about gratitude.
Mm. Well, throughout your career as a golf writer, did you...
Again with the golf?
Yes. No, this, it's a segue into gratitude. Did you feel that gratitude for, you know, having found your way, having found a great career that spoke to you, having had success in writing books and in your career? How did that or some other genesis of gratitude occur?
That's an excellent question. So, to be very clear, it's not like I had one career, wrapped it up, and started the next. I started writing letters of gratitude Thanksgiving of 2013. I wrapped up the golf writing in 2018. So there was a 5-year period where I was overlapping. And the answer to your question, which was a beautiful question, was I grateful for the opportunities that were presented to me as I traveled the world and went to tournaments and got flown to the UK and to New Zealand and lecturing on cruise ships? Was I as grateful when that was happening as I am now that I'm more fully focused on gratitude? The answer is a definitive no. I was talking the talk and writing the letters, but I wasn't quite walking the walk, and I never really thought of this until you just brought it up. Because I lived a very privileged life traveling as the guest of municipalities or resorts or states or even countries. Ireland would fly me over, or Scotland. And yeah, you become very quickly used to that kind of life. All of a sudden it becomes like, oh, well, this is how life is now. And now looking back at it, now that it's over, I should have been a lot more grateful when that was happening.
It is, it's a common thread that you hear a lot with people that are doing things that they love, and they get, you know, like you said, you're in this whirlwind, you're traveling around, you get all this experience and exposure to a beautiful life and a very privileged life, and it's very easy to get stuck in it and not realize how grateful you are for that moment.
Yeah, you can't see outside of yourself. You're in it, you're not looking from the outside in, and if you were, then you would be more grateful.
Exactly. And so in that time when, you know, you, like Forrest Gump, you got pretty tired and you're gonna go home now with golf, are you, did you have a moment when you sat down, did you feel depleted or less grateful in a sense that you said, I need to shift the way my life is running? Or was this just an exercise you just did to write that gentleman a letter that transformed your life?
So I love that question. When I wrote that first letter of gratitude, Thanksgiving week, give or take, of 2013, it never occurred to me that I would write another letter or a dozen more or 100 more or 200 more. I just wrote that letter. But it made me feel a warmth that compelled me to sit down at the computer a week or 2 weeks later and write another letter to someone else. So it was never like, okay, golf is over, let's become a gratitude expert. It was a slow but subtle metamorphosis into, and by the way, the greatest line I ever heard, I'm gonna steal it for myself. A woman I wrote a letter to years ago, she was a golf champion, won the U.S. Girls Junior Golf Champion, the New York State Amateur Champion, and gave it up. She became a doctor, and her colleagues cajoled her out on the golf course one day. She hadn't picked up a club in 10 years, and she shot about 75, a few over par. And they said, her name was Dahl Miller. Dahl, you have to take up golf again. And I'm going to steal Dahl's great line. Golf was something I did, not something I do. And that's how I feel about it. I still enjoy playing, but the whole life I led when I would drag what I called my rolling coffin, my traveling golf bag around the world for 20 years, I will never do that again.
Yeah, it's a lot, that travel and schedule for sure, especially on the golf course. Joel, how has your life morphed throughout this whole process, through this last decade? Because you say don't sweat the small stuff, and I agree. Lynn and I do a lot of interviews on the show, and I've read a lot of books where we speak with individuals about finding those minute things throughout your day that make a shift, whether it's the fresh air or the bird chirping or the leaves rustling, just having the gratitude of being on planet Earth and being an American. And how has your life changed in that sense? Has it changed you as a person, or were you always someone of more energy and more gratitude, if you will?
Energy, yes. Gratitude, I don't think so. You just reminded me of one of the most important points I can make today, and I'm going to make it at the library, Park City Library, next week. When you become grateful, you will still be the same pain in the ass that you are now. Nobody is turning into Mahatma Gandhi writing letters. So all of us have a lot of bad qualities, myself included, times 10. Competitiveness, resentment, anger, frustration, depression, all the human foibles that all of us deal with to one degree or another. By writing letters of gratitude, you help balance the scales a little bit. But I am not here to say on the radio or next week at the library, write letters of gratitude and now they're going to be calling you the Dalai Lama. That's not how it works. It's just a way to help balance out the negative aspects of our collective personalities. And I take a lot of pride in the fact that I may be this, I may be that, I may be this bad guy, I may be that bad father, bad grandfather, bad husband, bad friend, but I've made a lot of people happy, at least for the 5 minutes, when they open up a letter and read it and go, oh my God, I can't believe I got this from him.
Social media. We post something negative on, say, Park City Bitch and Complain or Nextdoor. You read those sites, and I am just baffled by the amount of negativity on this. And as you were answering David's question, it made me wonder, do people post a lot of negativity, but then they sort of balance it out by going and showing their gratitude towards someone else?
You're describing me.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I hope I don't find any posts from yours.
I bite my tongue, so to speak, on the keyboard, believe me, 100 times a week.
But it does make me wonder about our seeming stream of negativity that mostly has come about and has been exacerbated by social media on sites like Nextdoor and the other one I mentioned.
Right. Well, I'm guilty, except I don't actually post anything for fear of recrimination. I see stuff on Facebook from Facebook quote-unquote friends, and I always want to hit them with a lacerating comment about, you look like, you sound like an idiot. I don't go on Park City Bitch and Complain because, God forbid, you put something there, they're all going to turn on you like the cannibals. You can't really say anything if you don't want to get in a flame-throwing incident, and I don't want to do that. But I want to reiterate what I said a minute ago. Just because I'm grateful, just because my new website is gratitudetiger.com, doesn't mean I don't have the same anger, the same sarcasm, the same snarkiness. And I would say I have it more than many, if not most.
Aha. Uh-huh. There is something...
The truth comes out.
There's something inherent about writing a letter, and I don't know if you pick up a pen and hold it. Oh, you type on the computer keyboard. Okay. So letter writing. I remember it was probably about 10 years ago on this show, we interviewed someone who wrote a book about the art of writing letters and how it returns us to a place that many of us have lost. And it was so beautiful. And I have to admit, it didn't start me on a letter writing jag.
Yes, but today it will.
Yes, today it will. But it did make me think about the text message you send the next morning after you've been at someone's house for dinner, and thinking through, instead of just saying thank you, that was nice, thinking about why it was nice and why you're really thankful for that. So I'm wondering, as a practice, what are the things that we ask ourselves to feel gratitude about? How do we get there?
Well, you brought up a great point. Thank you for mentioning something that's very important. People have asked me over and over, do you type or do you handwrite letters? And of course, there's an advantage to each. The handwriting is, of course, more personal. I have an archive that's now 10 years old of every letter I've written to everyone I've reached out to, which to me is invaluable. I know what I said to who, when I said it, and what was the context. That's the beauty of the hard drive and the computer. So my letters of gratitude are typewritten, which is not to say I don't write thank you notes for a dinner party, for example. I've wrote a letter of gratitude to someone, and a few people in my life have gotten more than one letter. Not too many people have gotten more than one letter of gratitude. A few have. If I've written you a letter of gratitude and tell you why I think you're dynamite, if I'm going to thank you for a dinner party, I'm going to write you a handwritten thank you card. You're not getting a second letter of gratitude, and I always feel compelled to do more than just send a text message. So it just depends how much you want to put into it. And some people are very busy, some people are very distracted. Lynn, you just said a second ago, you had someone on the art of letter writing 10 years ago, and you were interested, you were probably motivated for about 15 minutes, but then you never wrote a letter. So I want you and David and everyone who's listening, all 12 of you, to consider writing a letter of gratitude to someone who is important to you, and do it in the next day or two. Don't say, oh, that's a great idea, and let life get in your way. Do it.
I'm going to do it for sure.
Me too.
One thing I want to say. I'm grateful for is the fact that I've never even heard of these complain websites in Park City and been on Nextdoor. I don't even know they exist. So
good for you.
I'm grateful for no negativity on those sites in my life. Joel, you talk about your website, gratitudetiger.com, and TIGER is a simple acronym that people can use. What is that acronym?
TIGER stands for Tapping Into Gratitude Engenders Rewards. So basically, it's a fancier way of saying, so it can fit the acronym, it's better to give than to receive. Tapping into gratitude, if you can tap into your own gratitude, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, proactively, not reactively. If you can tap into gratitude, it will engender rewards. It will come back to you. Never mind that hundreds of people who've gotten letters from me, at least for 10 minutes, said, that Joel, he's not that bad a guy after all. That's the secondary advantage. The bigger advantage is it makes you feel really good to write the letters. And one of the things that I'm going to outline in my lecture next week at the library are the 7 reasons why you write letters of gratitude. There are 7 very compelling reasons. And depending on our time frame, I want to give you one if we have a chance to talk about it now. There are 7, but I want to give you the latest one, and I've never said this aloud. Do we have a moment?
We do.
Okay. 7 reasons to write letters of gratitude. Here is a really compelling one. When you write a letter of gratitude, only 2 things can happen. You're going to pass away before the recipient, or the recipient is going to pass away before you. If the recipient passes away before you, one of the first things you're going to think when you hear that your friend, your mentor, your college buddy passed is, I'm so glad I wrote them a letter. And conversely, if you pass, I hate to be so maudlin, but what can I tell you? If you pass before the recipient, when the recipient hears about your demise, one of the first things they're going to think is, my God, he wrote me such a nice letter 3 years ago. So of the seven reasons to write letters of gratitude, the legacy concept is as compelling as any of the six other reasons. That's one of the seven tenets I'm going to touch on at the library on June 6th next week.
You have to show up to get the other six. What's the difference, Joel, between gratitude and thankfulness?
I'm not sure there is really. Gratitude to me, you know, if you're asking me to answer off the cuff, gratitude's a little bit deeper, a little bit more permanent. When you feel gratitude, you know, I'm thankful that you passed me the napkins. You know, I had ketchup on my face, but I'm not grateful that you passed me the napkin. You just did the right thing. So in a word, I guess gratitude is a little bit more permanent.
So Joel, I've been thinking here as we've been talking about my letter of gratitude that I'm going to write within the next day. And I've thought, well, what will I start with? Is there a form that you address each time in each letter, or is it just kind of creative, whatever you come up with?
You guys are really good at this job. You're asking excellent questions, and the answer is there's no right way or wrong way to do it. One of the things to fill out some space, so let me put it this way. When you were a kid and the teacher said, I want you to write 100 words on your summer vacation, most of the kids would write, I went to camp. Okay, I need 96 more words. That was not me. I could write the whole page. Not everyone is as loquacious as I am. So one thing you can do, Lynn, to start a letter, and I've done it dozens, if not scores of times. Dear Bill, you're really surprised to be receiving this letter from me. We haven't been in touch in 10 years. But I want you to know, .. You were a great fill in the blank. Roommate, mentor, army buddy. We haven't spoken in years, cousin. But I want you to know when we were kids up at the lake house, how much that meant to me. So you can start a letter of gratitude by outlining the fact that the recipient is really shocked to get it from you. And just share your feelings.
Next Wednesday, June 6th, 6 to 7:30 p.m.
I think it's Tuesday.
Oh.
I think it's Tuesday, June 6th.
Well, we better look it up. We'll
somebody
it
get on the
post.
Calendar.
Tuesday, June 6th.
Ah, Tuesday, June 6th. Okay. That's
I think it's
right.
At 6 p.m.
6 p.m. There
Library.
We go. Library. Okay. Joel Zuckerman, it's the Park City Library Speaker Series.
Yes.
There are other speakers. It happens about once a month. And Tuesday, not Wednesday, Tuesday.
June 6th.
June 6th.
Okay. 6 p.m.
Thanks for joining us, Joel Zuckerman.
Thank you.